Hello, everybody, and welcome back to You Can't Win. This is Tom here, and I'm joined by Don as usual. Today we have returning guest Lessons, also known as Alex. He's going to be talking to us a little bit about, well, he listened to our last premium episode, and he said he liked it, but he had some remarks, some quibbles that he wanted to raise, and we're just going to see where that goes. So, Alex, why don't you get us started off here and tell us what you were thinking.
Okay, I want to mention, first off, last time I came on, I talked about climate, and I said there, you know, I'm not an expert, but I'm sort of was an informed layman. This is a situation where I'm not even that, you know, I don't really know anything about economics beyond just, you know, dummy stuff, reading articles, some books, listening to people. So this is basically just me giving my opinion, you know, I'm not going to claim any sort of authority on this. You know, to the extent that I do know anything about economics, it's all the Marxist stuff, which is, you know, not mainstream at all. It's all heterodox. But, you know, I know a little bit about it.
Sure. So I should I'll interrupt just for a second and say that, yeah, so I have a BA in economics, and I should say that just to, you know, clarify on that too, is that like in a BA in economics, what you mostly learn is the simple graphs and stuff and just some of the basic concepts. And I was even in the lower end of that for that because I sort of got streamed into a non-math version of it kind of thing for most of it. I did take the mathematical economics courses and that and just barely got through those ones basically. But, you know, my senior seminar capstone kind of course was in the philosophy of economics. And I wrote about it. And so I'm not like a economist, do I mean really? But like I know enough that like I could have gotten hired at like a Pete Buttigieg job kind of thing, you know, maybe if I had like done better. But like so yeah. But anyways, just so that I think, and the other thing that's important too is that I think that a lot of like most of the people that are sort of like think tank people are about probably of that level too. They're not like there is kind of like a I read a book about economics like as a profession once that said that economists think of themselves like as a community, as anyone that has like a PhD from a top school kind of thing. So that's right. How narrow they kind of look at it as a thing. And then anyone else is kind of doing policy work and stuff. And I don't know. So anyways, but back to you about ideology and things like that. So, yeah.
Well, maybe we can actually go a little further on that to start, sure. Though. But just to tip my hand, I'm kind of going to try to play devil's advocate here on a certain point that came up early on, where you were kind of talking about how people just dismiss economists and be like, oh, you know, you just want to make sure that nothing ever changes and that, you know, the world doesn't get any better. Yeah. And, you know, there is a lot of that, and a lot of it is stupid, but I sort of agree with it. You know, this is kind of the dispute I always have with the left. It's like, you know, you guys seem like idiots, but, you know, I think you're kind of like going in the right direction. Sure. Going back, maybe we can talk about how economics is taught. And I think this kind of leads into that point that I just brought up, whereas if you go into an economics 101 course, microeconomics, you really will open up the book and there'll be stuff in there like, you know, if you have a minimum wage, all that's going to do is just create unemployment, and because, you know, and they'll have a demand curve and equilibrium graph up there, and they'll say, you know, if you mess with that graph, you know, by putting in a minimum wage, you know, you're just shooting yourself in the foot. And, you know, a lot of people at the higher level are pretty, not every economist believes that. I don't think, you know, like Paul Krugman believes that, but, you know, maybe he does, but he thinks it's a necessary evil. But there really is a lot of that stuff at the lower level where it's just, you know, pure ideology.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's one of those things where I agree with you. It's actually, I mean, in a way, like in my recent Jacobin article, I did agree with you in this general area, I think maybe a bit, where I was saying that, like, you know, you do have this kind of skepticism towards experts, and what they lean on a lot of the time is that what they're saying is completely true within the model that they're presenting, but not necessarily relevant to actual policy sort of decisions, right? Mm-hmm. So like I think that like all the Econ 101 stuff that they kind of say in those books, it's like definitionally true for the situation that they're presenting in the math kind of thing, right? It's not
right.
So it's a very, so the way that they kind of progress in the economics as an education thing is they want you to know what sort of pressures there are in each direction on these different graphs kind of thing, right? So if like a lot of it for like macroeconomics and stuff, it's like, you know, if you expand spending at this certain point, will it create inflation or not, or something like that? That's like really where a lot of this stuff ends up, you know, directing is, or a lot of, I mean, 99% of the stuff is used for like business economics, right? So it's like,
right,
you know, if the price of copper goes up, will the price of aluminum go up, or something like that kind of thing, right? So that's where a lot of it, and we had a, you know, a friend quined online on something awful, and he kind of had this, and I think a few people have said this, but he said, there's an economics, which is the price of copper goes up 5%, you know, then demand will go up, whatever, right? Or down. But, and then there's a second economics, which is that like millions of people die from preventable illnesses every year or something, right? So, and I think that like, once you kind of get into the Marxist kind of critique of that, the, and start looking at number one, that the, even that first economics is not really sustainable and makes sense even within its own terms. But then more importantly, that the second part of economics is not talked about almost at all as a, you know, it's not like Joe Biden or, you know, different top policy people in the States are talking about global poverty or something, right? So I think that's, you know, that's, anyways, that's the kind of spiel I think is interesting about that. I don't know. So, yeah.
Just as an aside, if you guys can, you should get Quinn on. Like,
yeah.
Definitely, oh, really, yeah. Really smart guy, you know, and
oh, have you talked to him recently? I mean, well, I guess, we can't. I don't know, we'll see.
But, I have not talked to him recently. The last time I talked to him was probably like 6 years ago, but I know he's still around. You might be able to put some feelers out there and get in touch with him.
Yeah,
that'd be great. Love to have him like kick a freestyle, you know?
But yeah, I hear where you're coming from, although I would say that there is a little bit of the higher level stuff in there, and it's all stuff like I said, like, you know, you shouldn't have a minimum wage.
Yeah.
You know, all interference in the market is bad, sure. And that, you know, that stuff gets in there. So they'll, like, I really don't understand how they get away with that. You know, sure. It's kind of an outlier in academics where, you know, if you do have some sort of ideological influence going on, it tends to be leaning more towards the liberal or the egalitarian side. Sure. Whereas with economics, it's, you know, very right-wing, very kind of like libertarian influenced, you know, for historical reasons, but... Sure.
I think there are other fields where there's very clearly like a political thing that you are supposed to fit, and it doesn't matter how solid the work that you're doing is, as long as it kind of reinforces a certain messaging, it's accepted as like,
sure,
yes, this is true because it, you know, reinforces what we believe to be true. It reinforces the orthodoxy. I'm thinking of things like, this is like you were saying, it's definitely more the like on the liberal left side of things, like gender studies type stuff or whatever,
or even, you know, some anthropology
is a good example. But yeah, I guess as far as like right-wing stuff, maybe you're right about that it's an outlier. I don't know if about like hard sciences, how much I just don't know as much about that in terms of like what it's like in academia, so maybe there's a bit of that there, but I don't know.
I think it's actually it's interesting to me because the high level like professors of economics at top schools kind of thing, they tend to split basically three ways, or like say grad students at those schools, they tend to split three ways in self-identification, and then between conservative, moderate, and liberal. So they actually, there are a lot of like numbers wise still a lot of professors that consider themselves liberal. The difference is that there's almost zero in even grad students that consider themselves radical. So like they've really extinguished the radical trend in economics, and all those people go to other places like sociology or cultural studies and things like that, and or political science, and they use those tools, maybe some economics tools in their work, but otherwise they're, you know, they've been pushed out of the profession that way. And I mean, as you know, Alex kind of points towards, is that is a very, very deliberate process, which is really interesting, where you know, you had all these really rich people buying chairs of economics and stuff and then choosing the people. And you had scholarships going to, you know, people that are right wing thinkers, and, you know, had police involvement.
George Mason University, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And that, I think what that has really changed, it's changed the profession at the top level, where it's, there's no radicalism there. And the person that you're going to, is going to be the left, like the most left wing kind of person you're going to get is like Paul Krugman or something like that, which is when there's a crisis, say we should spend more or something like that, or use exotic monetary policies to boost the economy in different ways. That is sort of the left edge of the spectrum that you're going to get in the profession. And then the difference is, I think, is that the entire bottom of, like, say, people that are sort of marginal, like policy advisors or anyone in that sort of general ranks of people that, say, do economic sort of work but are not necessarily theoreticians in it, I think that that has skewed very, very heavily right wing now. Like, that is, I think in the 70s and before that, they were more, much more likely to be liberal. And even before that, maybe even radical. But now the assumptions of that group are like very, very right wing in general. And I think a lot of that is because of the, you know, they're being told to talk in terms of political possibilities, right? So they, they, it's not like, even if they wanted to do work on things like how to construct single payer healthcare or something like that, all they really care about is how do you pay for that in a certain way? How do you do, you know? So it's like, so I think instead, a lot of these people that are more liberal are kind of submerged in jobs that are like social work oriented, or, you know, working for a pension fund or something, not necessarily actually doing high level sort of post-war Keynesian social democratic consensus kind of work that was being done, or like New Dealer kind of stuff, you know? So I don't know. I think that is really, and that's the kind of person that I was kind of criticizing, I think, in the episode, was, you know, this dominant kind of economist like kind of stuff, where you just kind of constantly get this churn of debates back and forth about even like the minimum wage stuff. It's kind of, it seems so secondary to the giant questions or something. I don't know.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, but you know, it's just kind of a thing that just gets banged on about endlessly, because, you know, based on first principles, and it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah. And I think that you're right that like people have an intuition that a lot of the right-wing economics kind of stuff is junk, and then therefore don't look into it because they're like, you know, it's like a waste of time. It'd be like looking into theology if you're an atheist and you don't care about that kind of stuff, you know? And then I think that's true. And I think you're right that that's true. But like, I also think that there's a problem there with, you know, I guess maybe because of my ideological training in the, my BA, like that, it does grind against me when I see a lot of popular kind of memes and stuff being pushed by think tanks that are like, actually, you know, raising minimum wage creates employment or something, you know, where they just take the opposite view. And then that kind of will grate against me because it's like, I don't know, I guess at that point it's like, does the argument even matter then? You know what I mean? Like, are you just, is it really an argument you're making, or is it just kind of a way of muddying the waters or something? I don't know. So,
yeah. Do you just want to fight with these other economists, you know, and nobody really cares about it, you know, or you're giving ammunition to, you know, your people on social media that agree with you? Like, that's not really advancing knowledge or policy or political change or anything. I definitely agree with that.
So actually, just, this is the one thing for economics that I think is useful for this, is that it insists on models and numbers to the extent that I think to myself, what is the person, not even like the think tank kind of person, but the person agreeing with that, I'm like, what, like, is the chain of logic in their argument that is getting them to agree with that or something, right? Like, so I think, like, say right now they said we need to, unemployment is, I don't know what it is in Canada, but like 5% or 6% or 7% or something. Mm-hmm. And they say we need to increase spending to make unemployment go down to, you know, create jobs, whatever kind of thing, right? And then most mainstream economists would be like, no, you can't do that because it'll create inflation or something, right? So if someone looks at a meme that says we have to create jobs by increasing spending because it'll, you know, make unemployment go down, whatever, I think, what is it in their past, what is it in their history that is making them believe that that progressive meme is true other than just prejudice.
Right? Yeah, like, probably not a lot, right?
And that's the thing. It worries me because I think in terms of, I feel like when you're in that kind of situation, it makes it people very, very easy to fool either direction or something, right? So,
yeah, I definitely agree with that. And there's also a kind of thing where, you know, if you bring up basically anything in economics, you know, people will just call you a neoliberal. They'll just be like, you know, if you're like, you know, this is the way that things are structured today. If you screw around with it this way, that's not going to work. Then people will just be like, oh, you know, you can't imagine the world being any different. And it's like, you know, no, it's the world is set up this way and it's bad, but, you know, it also still does work that way. And I totally hear that. And I think, you know, that's where, we probably don't disagree that much on this. Sure. But I would like to also emphasize the opposite point that why I'm kind of sympathetic with these people, which is really coming from the Marxist perspective. You know, as I said, that's where I kind of got my, you know, all the economics that I actually do understand, I got from there, and also a lot of the more political stuff. And in Marxism, there's this idea of the critique of ideology, which, you know, it's not really made explicit. It's been taken up by people since then. You know, Zizek talks about it a lot. But it's kind of summed up in this statement in the manifesto where they say something like, you know, the law, religion, everything from the perspective of the proletariat appears like a bunch of bourgeois nonsense. You know, that's very, very much a paraphrase. Mm-hmm. Where the idea is that, you know, even if there is all of this, you know, reason going in behind this math, method, you know, historical analysis and stuff, the reason that economists keep getting stuff wrong is because of they basically just work in the interests of the bourgeoisie. They work in the interests of the ruling class. And I think that's basically true. You know, I'm dumbing down the idea a bit, you know, sure. But, you know, I think that, you know, at the very basic level, that's true.
Yeah.
And you see this kind of stuff all the time where, like, you know, Davos is still going on, just got done, I'm not sure. But you see this stuff at Davos all the time where you'll have people get up there and talk about, you know, a real social problem, like, say, income inequality. And they'll come up with all these reason, you know, good reasons why it's, you know, destabilizing, why it's a bad thing for society and the economy, you know, how it's holding us back, how it's creating political turmoil. And then at the end, they'll be like, well, you know, so we should increase equality of opportunity. We should, you know, have more social mobility. And it's like, so, oh, you know, you don't actually care about the problem at all. You're not interested in solving it at all. All you really want to do is, like, figure out what lie you can tell people to get them to, you know, stop doing stuff we don't like, like electing Donald Trump or voting for Brexit or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's kind of, you talked about this being in the last, you know, few decades coming about. You know, I definitely agree it's gotten worse. But to a certain extent, it's always been like that.
Yeah.
You know, even when it was Keynesian or even, you know, in the 19th century where you had a lot more diversity in economics, you know, it was always really kind of like this. What these people's purpose is to make sure that the economy runs for the purposes of capital, basically. You know, they might even be worse than the bourgeoisie. I mean, the bourgeoisie at least has you know, they have some sort of ambition to transform society in a better way. Whereas if it's someone like Paul Krugman, all they're really interested in is stabilizing capital and making sure that it grows as fast as possible.
But, I mean, that's not really how they think about what they're doing, you know? I don't think they consciously think, like...
No, they don't. Nobody gets up in the morning and is like, how can I advance the interests of the working class? Of course not.
Right.
But that's what they do in effect. And
I hear what you're saying. Well, my point is, I think what you're Here's how I see it. I think the like you said that they're often wrong because they're basically just doing the they're performing this function in the service of capital. I don't see the necessary connection between being wrong and serving a reactionary politics. You know, I think just as often people who are serving a like populist or revolutionary or left kind of politics are also wrong all the time. And
oh, I absolutely agree with that. Yeah, yeah.
So I don't think there's a necessary connection there. I think it's more that when you are when your job is functionally to protect certain interests and to obfuscate certain like economic operations and class conflict and stuff like that, you are basically presenting a schematic kind of narrative that will hide certain things or naturalize certain things and all that kind of stuff. And you probably have that internalized, and that's why you are effective at delivering that kind of narrative. It's because you just believe it yourself, right? Like they always say, the easiest way to become a good liar is that you believe the lie that you're telling. So I think that's kind of what's happening. But what's it's also happening on the left or on people who are trying to counter that narrative, they're also producing their own schematic kind of view of things, and it also has the same kind of functions of hiding certain things and obfuscating certain kind of things. And it's perhaps less rigid because it doesn't have the requirements of it has to protect certain things. It can be more flexible because it's not beholden to certain interests in the same kind of way. I don't know, that's sort of how I see it. Do you guys get what I'm saying?
Well, I couldn't have put it better myself, really. I absolutely agree with that, and that is something that is kind of left out in the traditional Marxist critique of ideology. But I think it's, you know, I'm a big fan of this obscure mid-century sociologist named Alvin Goldner, and he wrote a big long essay called The Dark Side of the Dialectic, which says, you know, basically that, you know, just as our kind of venal interests and the interests of power, state, capital can mislead us, you know, our highest ideals can mislead us too. And what you said is being misled by the interests of the ruling class. Yeah, that's possible, but it's not necessarily worse than what the left does. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't necessarily mislead you anymore. Right. What I would say, you know, sort of in the defense of those kind of things, is that, you know, at least they have the right interests. You know, their interests are, you know, not Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. You know, it's ordinary people. And, you know, I think that's at least, they're at least on the right side morally. I'm not sure that they're on the right. I'm not sure that it actually gives them any advantage as far as reason goes. Which is what the traditional critique of ideology would say, but I'm not sure I buy that.
I tend to agree with that, but I still think it's a little more complicated than all that. Like, I think you tend to find people with more like pure intentions, right, on the left side of things. But even I think on the right, there are people who really do believe that what they're arguing for is better for people than what the left is, and so they're genuinely trying to create a better world. It's just that they kind of see it in this sort of like, you know, sometimes you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet kind of a thing. And on the left, even I think sometimes you encounter people who have made certain like weird compromises in their mind along that same kind mm-hmm. of logic, where it's like, oh, well, you know, in order to get to this end goal, I have to kind of lie about this or cut, you know, kind of cut corners here. And in effect, it kind of ends up doing the same thing. And so like good intentions are, you definitely need that to start with, but it's not really enough for me to justify something if you end up in effect not really being very productive or helpful, and also just, you know, doing exactly the same thing about in terms of like obfuscating, you know, power relations and stuff like that. So
sure, I do agree with that. What I would say that, you know, even if they believe like the you know, if you're talking about like a mainstream economist, even if they believe they're trying to make a better world, all they ever really say is, oh, we have to keep doing things exactly how we're doing them, and there's no other option. It's not possible or desirable. And I mean, it's pretty much across the board. You know, there may be, like, people may be willing to countenance some very, very minor changes. You know, like Don said, you know, maybe we have to do some deficit spending, but there's really not a whole lot of, there's no vision of a different world.
Yeah,
not that it's possible, and if it was possible, we wouldn't want to do it, and it would just end in totalitarianism or something.
I think that's true, but it's also the fact that the profession has been changed deliberately to reflect that set of values. And I think that was probably, I mean, that was probably still dominant throughout, because it's, you know, the dominant ideas are going to be the dominant classes kind of thing. But, like, I think that the difference is that, you know, within academia, a lot of the people, it's not like, you know, there are still more academics in general over time kind of thing. But, like, it's just that work is being done. That critique of the economy from a more left-wing perspective is just being done by people who call themselves different things now. You know, like, even right. Economist is, you know, even like the word economics as a thing now is sort of a, it's like an evolution from political economy, which split up into a bunch of different things, right? So, and not only that, but there's different components, obviously, of the same sort of thing. Like, so my BA was in economics, but I did a master's in political and legal thought, it was called. And what I ended up doing it on was, and to some extent, about Marxist stuff in China and that. And that all obviously relates back to economics in different ways in my mind, but it's autonomous within academia because of the way that it's structured by the state, basically. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's the different social sciences are sort of like just different guilds, you know, different perspectives on the same thing.
Sure. And,
you know, not totally. They obviously have their own... different, they do different things, and they talk about different subjects, but they're all, you know, to a certain extent, they're all kind of doing the same thing, and it's just all ghettoized. I definitely see that.
I'm sure you have, I know you have a lot of opinions about this too, is that within each of those more radical self-described departments, like sociology and things, that, you know, that a lot of that ends up being very superficial resistance and stuff too. I don't know, like, you know, like that, a lot of the departments that think of themselves as being quite progressive and on the edge of things, you know, in reality reflect a lot of the times ruling class values in different ways and stuff, or at least in their practical things.
Yeah. So. Or, you know, their own kind of like the values of the academy itself and, you know, the kind of people that work in the academy.
Yeah. So, yeah, like with identity politics and related to that. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things about this too is that, like, the only way that it works, you know, like the Marxist critique works, is because of that gap between reality and appearances kind of thing, where it has to be the case that bourgeois economists are constantly producing mistakes in their work and constantly producing class perspectives from their, you know, from their, that mistake the whole, because that's the only possible way that socialism would ever win, right? Like, if they were perfect managers, then they would never be able to overthrow society, right? Like, you know what I mean? They would never.
Right.
And obviously the mix of that is that if the proletariat knew its own position in society perfectly, it would not, if socialism is correct, would never continents being oppressed like that. So there's got to be some double thing going on where the bourgeoisie does have an error about its moral judgment and, you know, intellectual pursuits and stuff, but then at the same time the average person has to be quite ignorant of a lot of the basic truths of economics and or like political economy.
Well, let's see, is there anything else that we should really talk about? Maybe how we could, like, what could improve the situation? Like, what would be, what do you think, Don, on what would maybe make economics less stupid, maybe make the responses to economics that you get from its radical critics less stupid?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of those things where I do think, you know, this is maybe the residue of Marxism in me, is that I think that it really has to be the result of organizing, really. Like, I mean, it's got to be where, you know, you've got more people in unions, got more people in institutions that are sort of pro-worker in different ways. You got to have more funding for college for low-income students and all that, you know, or whatever. Like different ways that people, it's like the whole general caste of society has to be pushed in a certain direction, or else, like, if you have unions that can fund research jobs, right, because they've got the apparatus mm-hmm. there, I think that changes, like, there has to be a material basis for the way that the ideological struggle happens or something, right? Like, it's got to, I don't know if it can actually work. Like, I think there's people like, you know, Matt Brunick or somebody that does a good job, I think, of just knocking down a lot of the basic arguments. But I don't think that, I think that can only work so far. You have to be able to translate it into a political response. Like, that actually, you know, is like a, it puts resources behind people who are fighting instead of just, you know, you can't just win it with good academic papers, because you got to think that, like, especially for something like political science or something where foreign policy and that, you're not going to win foreign policy arguments just by being like, oh, you know, invading Iraq is a bad idea, here's the reason why, or something, right? Because that has almost no relationship to, and it's the same thing with like a lot of economic stuff. If you're like, you know, it would actually make sense to, say, increase funding for programs for the poor, because then they wouldn't be imposing all these medical costs or something like that. I think that is, it can point to symptoms, but it can't point to solutions for most actual things, because there's just not the political basis for the change unless people are organized to do it or something. So, yeah.
I do agree with that. But I would say the rub there is that that's very hard. You know, it's not, and it's not that people haven't been trying. Like, people who are way smarter and more dedicated than us have been trying to revive the American labor movement for decades, and it's only gone downhill. And I think part of the reasons for that, you know, are, you know, deeper than either, you know, having the right policies or, you know, just trying to organize social movements. Society is just becoming more fragmented, and it's really hard to get the kind of solidarity that you would need to build those institutions. I think, you know, we kind of touched on this last time, but I think one of the things we could do is try to, you know, come up with ideas that would be more convincing to people. Because I'm not sure how much of it is structural. I think that if we it's kind of gotten really polarized, where the only options that you have are, you know, you're either going to just keep doing exactly what we're doing, and, you know, you can have the conservative Republican response, or the Democratic or social Democratic response, or on the other hand, you know, you're just going to completely change everything and get rid of capitalism, you know, next week. And, you know, the first one, you know, it's certainly, you can certainly do that. I don't know if it'll make anything better. My intuition is that problems are just going to keep building and building up, and there's going to be, you know, not necessarily a catastrophe, but, you know, society will just slowly get worse and worse. And the other stuff just seems to me like you're, you know, I don't see how you would get there from where our position is right now. Sure. And so, I definitely agreed with a lot of the critiques you made of the kind of things that people want to do, where they're like, oh, we're going to abolish housing. You know, that doesn't seem like it's going to work. And you know, the kind of very traditional revolutionary socialist stuff, I just don't really see the constituency for it. You know, the working class doesn't really go for that anymore. The people that do seem to be going for it are more, you know, people are mad at the term PMC, but, you know, you know what I'm talking about if I say that. So, you know, I'm kind of, you know, more interested in what are other things that we could do that are not one of those, but also, you know, that might get all sorts of different people on board.
Yeah.
So whenever I see somebody advocating something really, you know, that I haven't seen before, I try to look into that, and I'll be like, well, you know, maybe this could, you know, this seems kind of crazy. Maybe that'll work. You know, part of, you know, I think that the way that this change you had in economics in the latter half of the 20th century happened was the Mont Pelerin Society. I mean, these were people who had very radical ideas, and they advanced them pretty much at the elite level. They didn't, there was no, you know, they had capital behind them, but, you know, Murray Rothbard or whoever obviously did not have a social movement behind him, and he didn't even really have an organized movement of business owners either. They just kind of had these crazy ideas, and they came in and they said, well, you've got this problem, we know how to solve it. And that may be a way that may, you know, that's one possible way that you could get through at least the beginnings of change. And hope, and I think you would need a whole sort of social movement and working class institutions and stuff like that to really push it all the way into a new paradigm of a new societal paradigm. But I'm not very optimistic about how you can do that just from the ground up.
Sure. Yeah, I know what you mean. There is, it's one of those things where elitism and debates within elites and stuff does get sort of a bad rap these days. You know, people immediately sort of shut off if you say these things should be happening between top level people or whatever. But yeah, I mean, it is one of those things where it's just sociologically true that there are those sort of networks and stuff that between people and, you know, it would be nice, you know, maybe in the long term, things are determined by the people. But, you know, there are sort of unique personalities and unique situations that can evolve that create almost like 10 unlikely things in a row happen. And then you've got a huge opportunity that you didn't have before or something like that. So maybe something even like the New Deal was, or the Soviet Revolution or whatever, like different things like that happened because of a bunch of things that happened in a row that opened up a door that, you know, would, mm-hmm. you know. But I think that, you know, just even to make it more concrete for some listeners and stuff, like, so what is your take on, so Bernie Sanders will be, I guess this would probably come out on Monday, and that is the day of the Iowa caucuses, I guess, right? So,
oh, yeah.
And what is your general, like, do you have much hope for him, or are you going to vote for him even?
I am going to vote for him. Yeah. What I would say is this, and I'd say I'm pretty positive on Bernie.
Yeah.
Let's see how I can phrase this. Maybe going back to social democracy for a second.
Yeah.
People are very down on social democracy, and I think that they have some good critiques. And I would just add mine to the pile here. To me, socialism isn't about getting some sort of good. It's not about getting some particular program. It's not about healthcare. It's about human liberation. And any sort of egalitarian movement, every egalitarian movement through history has been about a higher ideal. When you had, you know, Rosa Parks didn't want a seat on the bus. She wanted freedom for black people. And mm-hmm. what makes me have to have some level of confidence in Bernie Sanders is that I know exactly what he wants. He wants a society that isn't completely dominated politically and economically by billionaires and by Wall Street. And I agree with both of those things. And I'm not, you know, I don't know if his policies or his presidency would be able to achieve that. And I'm quite critical of the people that are around him right now. I think they've kind of steered him in the wrong direction and diluted his message and put in all sorts of stuff that shouldn't really be there. But, you know, it's good enough. You know, it's one of the, you know, few rays of hope we've had over the past, you know, many decades of defeat.
And so just to follow up, I mean, the stuff that you don't like as much would be associated with sort of the more woke identity politics sort of thing. Is that what you mean? Or is it?
Yes, basically. And also that I think I'm not sure how many people are really really interested in this stuff. You know, like during the last campaign, Bernie Sanders, you know, came out and said, you know, I don't want to open borders. That's a Koch brothers policy. Yeah. And people yelled at him and he didn't care, but he's kind of got people around him that have basically brought him around to that position. And I don't really see what the use of that stuff is. Like, I don't even think illegal immigrants want open borders. They want amnesty, you know? Yeah. And I think that would be that's a perfectly good thing to advocate for. You know, you could get 11 million people, 11 million illegal immigrants, citizenship. That would be great. That would be a wonderful step in the right direction. And it might not give us everything we want, but I think that that's something that is acceptable to a broad majority of the American people. It's been shown in opinion poll after opinion poll. Whereas the stuff about, like, you know, I think he doesn't say open borders, but he says something like, you know, decriminalizing illegal entry or something. And I don't really see where the constituency is for that stuff. You know, you can find it on, you know, woke circles, college campuses, well-off, you know, offices and stuff like that. But I don't think that there is a I don't think there's you're going to get a broad section of the U.S. population behind that.
Sure. And so do you think he's going to win or no?
You know, I have no idea. You
Okay.
know,
Yeah.
I think that he has a very good chance to win the nomination. I would be
Yeah.
more worried about the general. And, you know, it's very hard to say. Like, right now the field is so divided. I think that we'll be able to know if he's going to win the nomination probably after Super Tuesday,
Yeah.
or at least, you know, have a very good idea, but I have no idea now. It's totally
Sure.
up in the air.
Yeah. Yeah, are you so I mean, I don't know. We can cut this if it's too personal or something like that, but are you involved at all in local organizing or doing anything around this stuff right now? Is it more just kind of still
Well,
engaged with debates and
that's
stuff?
actually interesting. I got a text from the Bernie campaign, and they said, "Are you all in for Bernie?" And I said,
Yeah.
"Yes." And they said, "Okay, do you want to come out and help?" And I never responded.
Yeah. No.
So,
It's not, yeah.
you know, maybe I'm gonna get more. You know, I've thought about it, but
Sure. Yeah. It's
I have
funny that,
not. I have
yeah.
not gone ahead and done anything. We'll see. You know, I'll make my decision after Iowa and New Hampshire and all that stuff,
Yeah.
because I'm in North Carolina, and
Okay,
that's
okay.
a Super Tuesday state, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure actually. I don't know North
I
Carolina,
think it
but
is.
okay. So are you signed up to vote for that one, or are you just going to vote in the general?
I am signed up to vote for that one, and I'll vote for
Okay.
him.
Good.
I don't
I
know
mean,
if I'm going to go ahead and get involved in the Bernie campaign,
yeah.
because I've kind of been turned off by the people in the campaign, even if I like
Sure.
Bernie himself.
Yeah. And then it's funny because I used to like just the idea of going door to door and all that just fills me with dread. And I couldn't imagine wanting to do that even like just and then I thought about it for a minute and I was like, oh, I used to do that. And I thought about it. I was like, 20 years ago, I used to go door to door and do campaigns for conservatives. So it's like I was like, oh, I do have experience doing that. And I was not that great at it, but it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't the end of the world. It was just not fun to do. But I don't
No,
know.
it's
But
not.
it is it's just a very I don't know. I respect the enthusiasm that I see of a lot of these people going out there to Iowa and all that because I don't have that gene or whatever of wanting to. I like to kind of go to. I thought it'd be cool to like maybe go to the United States for Super Tuesday or something and just hang out or something, you know, just walk around or something like some of the Bernie parties. But the idea of phone banking or something, I think part of it is. I'm not sure if Tom had this or not too, but you know the it's memories of the Obama years in the 2008 and stuff where people on Something Awful were just you know phone banking was a big thing and it just seems so stupid to me at the time. I think I've got like a residue of like a hangover of that maybe a bit where I'm like just seems really cringy to want to spend all that time on the phone with random people. I don't know. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I hate all that stuff. I'm like a big crank about all that. Like every text I get from Bernie people, I just block it. I don't respond to it or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's not like justifiable, but I do get like this. Just I don't know. It's just, I just find it completely I don't know, unjustified or something. Like just leave me alone. It
Yeah.
doesn't matter. I don't care
Well,
that you're on the campaign.
the Obama people, you know, the part of the thing that was so annoying about them is they were all like, you know, Ralph Wiggum, I'm helping. You know, it seems really, it is really cringy.
Yeah, that's a it's funny too because it's collective action at its very basic kind of thing, right? Like it's not it's like a very low level thing, but it is one of those strange things where it's just it is amazing how much they can mobilize now around these things though. Like the money that Bernie's raking in, you know, it's just huge amounts of money compared to, you know, 20 years ago or something for left-wing campaigns. And I don't know. It's funny because, you know, people do complain. They say, you know, we couldn't get people to raise $100 million for anything else or something, right? Like, you couldn't just have a crowdfunding campaign saying, you know, let's get $5 million for a left-wing research institute or something like that. Really, you're not going to get that, right? So it's funny because it has proven to me, at least at some level, that, you know, electoral politics at least can be a, you know, lightning rod or something, you know, like something where average people feel like they can sort of chip in and help out, and in a way that they have very high commitment stuff that people offer otherwise that doesn't really fit with their lives at this point. So, yeah.
There is something about the Bernie campaign. It seems like there's kind of two basic groups that it appeals to. One seems to be the larger group, which is kind of like the average American, for whatever, you know, that's worth, like the average working American. But then there's the more vocal and seem to be more influential on the campaign, these people that, like, you call them the PMC or the woke crowd, or, you know, that sort of like the college educated, like they don't really need the help so much. Like they might really benefit from having their student loans dismissed, and they might really like some healthcare, but it's not like they're really hurting for it, that kind of a thing.
Right.
I saw some guy tweet about how desperate he is that he, you know, he's paying $200 a month for his healthcare, and I was just thinking, like, you're for Bernie because of $200 a month? Like, what about Yang? Like, Yang will get you $1,000. Isn't that, like, going to help you out more? And I'm just a bit concerned that if those people, if that's really the crowd that start to have more influence on this whole movement, there's going to be a split where, you know, at some point where they're kind of there because they see themselves as fighting on behalf of working Americans, and working Americans don't actually have their own voice. They just have this like surrogate voice. And at some point there's going to be conflict there. It's, you know, something where, you know, something will come up. Maybe it's the borders thing, for example. I don't know. And
they haven't organized those people either. You know, those people are basically just showing up. You know, they're like, oh, I heard what Bernie said. I think he's got the right idea. I'm going to send him $27.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where that's I mean, that's what the other thing that I put in the article about that stuff is. I mean, it's funny because it's just that's the second thing that is that a lot of these populist campaigns are. You know, Bernie is very, in his messaging, is very emphasized this, but it does, at the end of the day, it's like, if you want to fix something, support me. It's not the same as saying, if you want to fix something, do it yourself kind of thing, right? Which is, there's not really, as Alex said, there's not really a lot of options for people to do that now in a way that is effective. There's ways that they could do it theoretically, but in terms of like commitment levels and knowledge and all that, it's a long, long process to get them there, I think. So that's kind of a gap that, you know, but I mean, at the same time, having a president that actually talks about these kind of things would be a huge step forward, I think. Yeah, in that way, because,
oh yeah, for sure,
even if you just have a president that is pro-union, like, down the line, I think that's better than, yeah, I think just putting it on the table is good in some ways. And
it's going to change people's minds. It won't necessarily, the kind of things that we would need to get the kind of change we want aren't going to appear overnight. Yeah. But, you know, it would at least get people, it would make people more open to them. Yeah. But as I said before, you know, it's, I would still kind of be pessimistic in the long run.
Sure.
Because of just the situation, the societal situation is different. You know, it seems to me like, oh, even if you did get a lot of those people engaged, even if there wasn't a split, you know, maybe they'll just all go online and be more people complaining all the time rather than actually building, you know, organizations in their community and so on. You know, it's hard to imagine it happening, but, you know, it's worth trying, you know.
I mean, it was hard to imagine Bernie happening in the first place, right? So, like,
things
can change pretty quickly.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised at how pro Bernie I'm being right now too, because I do have like it's funny because I still have a tendency in my mind that it's because people I know are excited about him. I go, oh, I hope he wins because of that kind of thing. That's
just, it's like the exact opposite instincts that I have.
Yeah. So, but I, you know, my tendency is to be otherwise just kind of like a wait and see person for a lot of this stuff. But I don't know. I think it's because we're also in Canada, not really, we don't have the same kind of energy around social democratic politics that the States has right now, where we have, I mean, a lot of the people sort of believe it, but we don't really have strong left organizations outside of Quebec, and the sort of national social democratic parties are positive in some ways, but you know, it's just, it's not, it's like a, they would be closer to a center left kind of person than like, there's no, there's not really equivalents of like AOC or something like that in Canada yet. So other than in Quebec, they've kind of got a strong social democratic party, which in theory at least says that they want to move beyond capitalism, and it sort of has become like a hub of a lot of, you know, it's really is like a strong sort of, or at least moderately strong, like new left kind of movement, which that's interesting to see, but it's not really, you know, it's at least in a party too. Like they've got a party form that is actually, you know, uniting a lot of people. It's still at the stage though, where it's just critique at this point, right? Like they're not able to lead a government or anything, but it's interesting to see at least, you know,
is that one of the major parties? Is it the PQ or their NDP or what?
So in Quebec, it's Quebec Solidaire, it's called. And I think that the National Assembly in Quebec has maybe 125, 127 members total. And this party has 10 seats right now. So that's actually, okay. I mean, for a left party in North America, you know, that's pretty good compared to, it'd be like, you know, like I think in the New York Senate or something, there's maybe four or five people who are sort of left liberal or something, but these are people that a lot of them are actually, it's actually really heartening in some ways that it's sort of like the range of left wing opinion is actually represented at some extent. You know what I mean? Like you got different, you know, radical people and social worker kind of people and all the different things that are sort of thing. It's not, you know, direct representation of workers, but it's, you know, it's a lot better than if that was replicated in other parts of the country. I mean, in North America, I mean, like, I think that would be positive. Yeah. So.
Okay.
So, you guys want to answer some questions and then we'll wrap this thing up.
Sounds good.
Sure.
Okay. Is real democracy possible under capitalism, or is it, as Lenin claims, a democracy for the minority, only for the propertied classes, only for the rich? As a follow-up, is individual participation in the democratic process immoral if it does help legitimize minority rule in a capitalist society?
Can you repeat the second half of that?
Sure. So, as a follow-up, is individual participation in the democratic process immoral if it does help legitimize minority rule in a capitalist society? So is voting and supporting the electoral system immoral?
Okay, I think the thing that I like about bourgeois democracy as it kind of... Number one, I think that given the range of historical sort of types of governments and stuff, I think that even a sort of half-assed democracy is still pretty good compared to... You know, it's like it's something... It's not something to be talked down to all the time or something kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like it's not, people exaggerate, I think, how useless it is. I think it really is positive in a lot of ways. Depends. I mean, obviously it's one of those things where the United States tends to be a pretty bad example of democracy in general, but it's still like the thing I think is beautiful is something like Jeb Bush in 2016, you know, like where he raises like $100 million or something, burns it all and tries to get something going and can't even, you know, no one cares. So yeah. That's someone that, you know, it's like the entire establishment sort of starts to rally around someone and there's no chance, you know, like just goes nowhere.
Yeah, people just give them the finger. Yeah.
I think that's beautiful in some ways. I mean, there are analogs, if you want to call them authoritarian or whatever societies. There are, you know, there's obviously situations where a leader thinks of themselves as being very popular and has all the support and then falls away or something. That does happen, obviously, a lot. But there's something beautiful about it happening just because average people just can't be bothered to show up for them. that's a lot better, I think, in a lot of ways, you know, and it's not, I mean, it's not like the outcome was much better. Like, you know, Trump still won and still is not like a good president, I guess, but it's still, it's even Hillary losing at some level is sort of, it's interesting, you know, it's like you had all and not doing well really in the primary in a lot of ways, other than, you know, it's like, you know, all these powerful elements can have all of these hands on the lever and everything, and they still can't get it done at the end of the day because average people are allowed to just kind of go, nope, you know. So I think that's worthwhile. That's not, you know, it's very, China has actually kind of gone in away from this recently, but there is something to me that's sort of sinister or strange, at least, of like the simulated democracy or something where, you know, presidents were in power for 10 years and then they took over, you know, they had 2 5-year terms and everything was, it was supposed to be really handed down. And so it was almost like everything was formalized to an extreme degree, but all the decisions are being made indirectly by, you know, it's like, that does scare me as a vision of the future for different things where, you know, you would have systems that appear to be at some level highly managed, but all by according to some sort of obscure procedure or something. I think that's something that could come about to some extent in the United States if you didn't have this ability of people to just ignore the result or whatever kind of thing that you've decided on your own. So yeah, I don't know.
Okay, well, the question of democracy is kind of, I think it's kind of a thorny one. And to be honest, my ideal would not be absolute democracy. It would be more like the end of politics, or yeah, at least the end of politics in the sense that it can impose itself on other people. And I think that democracy is kind of there just to keep us from tearing each other apart about the fights we have over resources and values and so on.
And that's a good thing, right? I mean,
yeah, that is a very good thing. And what I would like to say most overall is that even if whatever ideal you're looking for, it's going to be based on a continuity with what we have right now. So if you have a very extremely dysfunctional system that's, you know, very authoritarian or just, you know, unresponsive to people's needs, you have small groups deciding everything and normal people have no control and no ability to control everything, that's just going to be bad, you know, even if you can get, you know, the new Bolshevik revolution or whatever it is you want, because you're going to inherit all of these institutions and people that are, you know, not prepared to make things better. So I would very much like to have democracy, you know, function as well as possible under capitalism, whether or not it can really be what we want and whether or not it can achieve, you know, the goals that liberalism sets out for itself. Because the better, you know, it, even if you can make it, you know, somewhat better, that's going to improve things, you know, in the short term. And it's going to make it much more likely that if you do gain power and you do get to transform society in all these crazy ways you want to, that you're going to have an inheritance to use for it rather than having to build it all from the ground up. I think part of the reason that everything turned out so bad in, you know, Russia and China and all this stuff is because they came into it with basically nothing. You know, they had very little tradition. And, you know, Marx thought, you know, it was going to be the advanced capitalist countries that were going to be doing this. And, you know, that didn't work out for a lot of reasons, but I think if it had, I would have been more optimistic about things not going so disastrously wrong.
Yeah, I actually agree with, I think, everything you just said. I always like to point out to people when they're talking about, like, how bad the Gulag stuff was in the Soviet Union, and I'm like, well, how much of that can we really attribute to communist theory and all that when it took place in Russia? Like, that seems much more of like a Russian thing than a communist thing.
So, yeah, that, you know, the first, Stalin didn't invent the Gulag.
Right, yeah. It not only predated the revolution, it also still exists in a sense. So it's not something that came and went with communism or anything. Just to, like, answer the first part of that question that asked if democracy is possible in a, let's call it like a capitalist society. I think it really depends on your definition of democracy, and then it's kind of like a moot point. Like, if you define democracy as including, like, let's call it economic democracy, right? Like, I've seen that term thrown around sometimes. Then obviously, no, it can't, because you know, that's just an inherent part of a capitalist society. But if you mean democracy in like the political system can be democratic, in that people have an ability to participate in it and all that kind of stuff, well then, yeah, obviously it can exist, because we see that all over the world. So, you know, it's sort of, it really depends on how you define it. And then in the end, how you define it answers the question for you, I think. So I don't know how useful a question it really is.
Yeah,
I think the Lenin statement there is, you know, kind of sloganeering too, you know.
Sure.
You can't, yeah. That's not theory there. And I think that's a perfectly fine thing to say if you're like, if somebody says, you know, this isn't real democracy, we don't have economic democracy, I think that's all fine. You know, that's perfectly fine as rhetoric.
Sure, sure. Okay. How do I get my wife to want to listen to the podcast with me? Well, you could just play it in the background, and I think our sexy voices will sort of just naturally attract her to want to listen to more.
If I had a wife, I wouldn't want her to see any of this shit. Like, I would compulsively hide it, you know, and be like, what are you doing on that computer? You know, shut up! So that's what I would encourage you to do, and, you know, don't let her know, you know, hide your interests compulsively and just get crazier and crazier.
Yeah, I would show her the picture of me in the cowboy hat and say that this person, you know, obviously loves defending the interests of women, and then they can listen to it and see how chivalrous I am and stuff. So, yeah.
Next question here says, climate discourse could be viewed as trolling for a jobs program. Agree? I don't quite understand.
Sure what he means.
Yeah.
Maybe he means that if we get everybody terrified about climate change, then they'll, you know, bring back the Tennessee Valley Authority. Something
like
that.
Like, it's sort of just trying to scare up a jobs program sort of thing.
You know, I mean, I wish it was like that. You know, I think what they actually want to do is, you know, make us all go live in huts, you know, in the woods and, like, eat dirt and stuff.
I'm fine with that.
You know, if it was like that, you know, they basically just want to, they want to get certain changes, but I never really see anything like a jobs program or, you know, well, I guess there's the Green New Deal, but that is more like, oh, we're going to give people who work at coal plants and coal miners, we're going to give them job training and stuff. And we're going to put people to work making solar panels.
And, you know, I have no faith in that Green New Deal stuff. It seems just like a bunch of bullshit. I don't know. It just doesn't.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan myself. I like the idea, but I went through and I read the program, and it's really wishy-washy and all over the place. And it was sort of like designed by committee. They got all these environmental groups together, and this is what they could all agree on. It doesn't seem very ambitious. I bet you could get, like, you know, 10 like-minded people in a room together who are really smart and are experts on this stuff, and they can come up with something better.
Right, right. It sort of reminds me of that John Podesta tweet that was like Hillary's plan to defeat ISIS, and it was like, defeat ISIS. Yeah. It's sort of like, you know, this is our plan to improve the economy and save the environment. Number one, save the environment. Number one, you know, number two, create jobs. It's just like, what's the plan? Like, you're just saying things you want to see happen, but that's, you know, that's not.
And they actually, it's crazy some of the stuff they leave out of there. They're like, they, when they go to talk about, like, they want to build renewable energy. Okay, that's good. And then they're like, well, you know, we're agnostic on whether this is going to be publicly or privately owned. It's going to be publicly financed, but we're agnostic on who's going to own it. It's like, how can you leave that out of your program? I mean, it's unacceptable. But that is, you know, what they could get, where they get, you know, all of these million, billion groups with no consistency together in a room, and that's what they can agree on. Because some people are going to be, you know, green growth capitalists, and some people are pot-smoking hippies and all that, and it did not come out well.
I think that I am fine with living in a hut, so I'm just going to go with that. I think that it would not really change my life much. I just would have less like PlayStation. Otherwise, I just kind of hang out and talk to people. And so I think that's fine. I don't know.
You could probably still podcast from a hut too. So it wouldn't even really impact, you know, our stuff.
Yeah. With like cans on string or something like that. Yeah.
might improve the audio quality even, you know? Yeah, yeah. Okay. So next question is, what is your favorite ethnic group? I'll start off answering this one. I like the pan-Turanist theory. That states that it's basically all the countries and ethnicities that like border the periphery of Russia. So like the Turkic peoples and Koreans and Japanese and Mongolians and the Magyars in Hungary and the Finns, they're all one people and they come from the original people of Sumeria. And so that's all Turan, right? So that's my favorite ethnic group. I think that eventually our day will come and we'll dominate the lesser races.
So my like favorite ethnic theory and therefore group is that Jewish people are mostly Italian. Like that's their DNA, which if you Google DNA Jewish mostly Italian or something, there's like BBC articles about it and stuff. So it's not like someone came up with it. And if you think of that, like number one, like think of someone like Woody Allen. And then just imagine that guy is Italian. You're like, oh, okay, that's very clearly true. Like, you know what I mean? It's just, he looks like just a Italian guy or something. And he could, you know, he would love being in the same ethnicity as like Fellini, you know, or something.
A lot
you know?
Of similarities when you think about it, like overbearing mothers and kind of like that's mercantile nature.
True.
And
kind of stuff. Well, yeah.
I think that someone that we know actually sort of came up with this theory. I'm not sure if they want to be named, but like that. So something like Sopranos, the family, right? They're all bickering and stuff, right? That's because a lot of the writers were probably Jewish, right?
Right.
So they're writing a Jewish family being the Sopranos, whatever. And then so that's why they bicker and like that, or any sort of mob movie like that, right?
Yeah. And going to therapy, all that kind of
stuff.
Yeah,
exactly. And then what's happened is Italian guys now in New Jersey, whatever, start emulating the TV show. So you could, if you do see like an Italian guy, you could say a lot of your mannerisms are actually Jewish, and they'll probably be happy about that, I think. So,
yeah, it's a mark of high esteem in the Italian community.
So,
what's your answer, Alex?
I guess I would go with the Twa or Batwa ethnic group.
What's that?
They're African pygmies.
Oh, okay.
They're like an indigenous people that lives in the Congo and other places in Central Africa. They do this kind of polyphonic singing thing, and their men speak on multiple registers at the same time. But they kind of had a really sad story where all the conflict going on there, people have gotten enslaved or driven off of their traditional land. And there was actually a whole thing where they made these guerrilla reserves, and the Twa got accused of killing the guerrillas, and they were kicked off, and they ended up as, you know, basically slaves for the dominant ethnic groups there, working in, you know, terrible conditions, and people, you know, living in exile, losing that indigenous culture. And, you know, there's a documentary on these people that you can see on YouTube, and they're really just amazing people. And I've never, you know, like nothing I've ever seen. And, you know, I don't want to, you know, be too romantic about the indigenous, you know, noble savage trope or whatever. But I just, you know, have a lot of affinity for those people because they have a very unique culture and they've suffered needlessly because of modernity.
That's cool. How tall are you, Alex? Just out of curiosity. no relation to the answer.
I'm a little taller than the pygmy.
Okay.
A little bit, you know, a couple inches.
Okay. All right. This one is kind of just for me and Don, but you can feel free to chime in if you have anything to say, Alex. As gay men in an interfaith relationship, how do you deal with conflict? Will you raise your children Muslim or Catholic, or will you let them decide? What do you think?
Yeah, we never go to bed early, angry. That's the...
we always
work it out. And I think that the kids would have to be brought up in both so that they could basically be useful in any situation in the Islamo-Catholic emirate. So, they need to be able to take any sort of role that, if we need them to be an imam in South Dakota or something, we could send them there. If we need them to be a priest in Quebec or something, we could send them there. So, yeah.
Well, here's my idea for that, is that we, at a certain age, like maybe 3 or 4 years old or something like that, we put a Bible on the floor and a Quran on the floor, and we see which one they crawl to, or, and then if they choose the Quran, we raise them to be viziers or something along those lines. And if they go to the Bible, we can raise them to be slave soldiers, and then they'll be able to fight, or be like our bodyguard. Yeah, exactly. Like a Janissary type situation.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
All right.
No problem.
No conflicts. It's really easy, guys.
Yeah.
Okay. This one is kind of interesting considering we were talking about the whole open borders issue. Someone is asking, would you consider having on Angela Nagel? I think that's how you pronounce the last name there. So she's kind of notorious for the open, I think she's against open borders or something. She wrote an article about that, so a bunch of people on Twitter hate her. I haven't read that article.
Yeah, she's a Strasserist who just wants healthcare, but she wants to, massacre minorities.
Okay, that's not the impression I've gotten from listening to her here.
Well,
and
that's what people say about her,
Right, she's right, right.
She's a slurcialist.
Okay. Well, I have a good impression of her from I've heard her on a few podcasts, and she seems like an intelligent person, and she doesn't really I don't know. I haven't really heard anything objectionable from her, but I know there's a bunch of, critics and whatnot. I don't know her, and I don't know that. I don't know. Do you know her at all, Don? Like, have you ever talked to her or anything?
No, I did get into a controversy with her publisher, Zero Books, on Twitter because I said that it was unconscionable that she called her book Kill All Normies.
Oh, right.
Calling people to kill average people. And her publisher wanted to make very, very clear that that's not the intent of the title. So I don't know. I don't usually agree with what she writes. And I kind of get, the open border stuff. I think that it's just the framing of it for me. I don't agree with and stuff where, I understand, we were cheering about Bernie earlier, but it's just, there's something about the way that it's like thinking in terms of being the person in power instead of the person at the bottom. Sometimes that becomes a problem for me because I'm like, I don't personally care as much about what the correct policy is as much as just, solidarity with the person affected by it or something. I don't know.
So, yeah, that's fair. That's a good way to look at it. Yeah, the thing is, since we don't really know her, I don't know how interested we are in having someone we don't know on just because they're sort of like a known entity in left circles or something. That's not really what we're trying to do. But I don't know. Who knows? I'm not against it or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would be happy to if she was on here. But yeah, as you said, it's your podcast. You mostly talk with your friends, so... Yeah, I'm not sure if it fits.
Yeah, but if we do have her on, we'll maybe get in touch with you, Alex, and we can drag you in here to...
Oh, yeah, I'd love to talk to her. I'd definitely like to see what, she and Don have to say to each other. Because I think that, a lot of the stuff that she says that gets blown out of proportion, I think she has made some mistakes in some stuff, and she's admitted that. Like, in the Open Borders article, she promoted this system called E-Verify, which is well, it doesn't really matter, but a lot of people got on her case about it. And she just basically said, well, you know, I talked to some people after this, you know, that are in the union movement, and they're like, yeah, it's not really that good. And she's like, yeah, I guess I was wrong about that. So, you know, she's not, you know, a horrible monster. She's willing to listen to reason and change her mind about things. Sure. So,
yeah. Other than the book that called for genocide. Other than that, I think she's probably...
Well, she's very... She's sticking to her guns on that one.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the publisher said that wasn't the intent, but I think that's kind of the beauty of art, is that you can always interpret things in different ways, and everyone can see what they want.
Yeah, that's what Roland Barthes said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thanks for coming on again, Alex, and it was nice talking to you.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Yeah. And cool.
Yeah. So thanks for listening, guys. If you want to have a second episode every week, you can subscribe to our Patreon and you will have that. You will also get access to our Discord where you can chat with us and our community, and you will be able to submit questions for the premium episodes and send us topic suggestions and all kinds of good stuff. And so thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
頭がパーで気が狂ってる。投資よりは頭固くて気が狂ってる。広学歴も低学歴も気が狂ってる。警察官はみんな悪に染まって。政治家はみんな賄賂もらって。ネットの奴らみんな性根腐って。我々人類は神に近づいて。そんな極論を言うな。 視野が狭くて気が狂ってるって言ってる奴の視野が狭くて気が狂ってるって言ってる奴の視野が狭くて気が狂ってるって言ってる奴の視野が広くても何も変わらない。